Midgetana, real six. So you're telling me your memories of Wingate?
Yes. Truthfully, I now look back over the years and I have the greatest admiration for him. I like to think I was honored to be among those he sought to have with him, bearing in mind, you will remember, that I did not volunteer to join his outfit. He sought me through GHQ postings. At the time, I didn't know what was happening to me, but I enjoyed is perhaps, again, not the word, but I seemed to fit in with all he required of me at that time. And I now look back something like 50 years to my consorting with him in the jungle areas and doing exactly what he asked of me. And I like to think that I did my job properly. I'm sure I did, because I've had more proof of that over the years. And secondly, I like to think that if he is looking down on me as I now talk from heaven, I like to think that he knew I did such as I could to assist him towards the success he ultimately achieved. Because success it was, there's no denying that.
But did you like him at the time?
Iffy about that one. At the time, I liked him in the sense that he seemed to allow me to take the lead. In a very careful way, he allowed me, as he put it once, "I give you an open check on this one, Frankie." Rarely did he call one by a Christian name. I never, of course, expected him to, nor would he normally, but there were the odd occasion when he would become a shade more friendly, perhaps. But I always stood smartly to attention to him, called him sir, liked him as a soldier, liked him for the kind of man he was, but couldn't understand sometimes his characteristics. But I get back to my repeating, however, that he never asked of another man more than he himself would give, were it necessary for him to do. He would lead from the front.
How did Wingate compare with Jack Masters?
They were of a kind, funny enough. Both of them had their idiosyncrasies. Both of them made us, ordinary mortals, do things we would not rather do. As an example, General Wingate loved his Bible. He always quoted from his Bible. That brought animosity from all ranks, because all of us have had education from the Bible from our early Sunday school days and onwards. But not all of us profess to know our Bible as he appeared to know his. But he, General Wingate, would tend to force his Bible teachings onto you. Later, when Jack Masters took command of our brigade, he, Jack Masters, made us do exactly the same thing. He literally made us. He and I were of the same rank at one time, though he was brigade major, where I was normally Major BATO 111 Brigade. But he was senior to me in that, A, he was the confidant of the brigadier, and B, as brigade major, he issued direct the brigadier's own instructions. So I was a lesser mortal rank-wise than he was. But he, therefore, or rather he did, therefore, seem to, as it were, sometimes think out of spite, would bring to bear the factor that the brigadier, now absent, having gone back to GHQ Delhi, he would bring to bear the full force of his acting brigadier rank and enforce that we, us other chaps, in going to camp at night, instead of allowing me to go on and tend to my mules and ensure their safety and for getting off tomorrow morning 0600, he would make me sit, he would enforce rather, that I should be among those who had to sit down and listen to his chapter from the Bible and or reading from Pilgrim's Progress or whatever other factor he would like to enforce first. So Jack Masters, who was initially my friend, became somewhat anti some of us, and he tended not to like me in his latter days. That is a feeling I've always had then, for no reason whatsoever, in that I had to, on occasions, say no to him when he wanted to. You see, a mule, a mule is destined to carry 80 pounds each side of his back, 160 pounds. If you put 200 pounds on his back, you know you're overloading this mule, and you know there's a limit to his abilities. Jack Masters would not think twice about that one and would order me to put 250 pounds on his back, should he so think. I did not agree and said so. That made me say no to a senior officer, which I dislike saying, and which in turn got me into hot water, if you like. It wasn't a chargeable offence. I had to say my piece. But the Jack Masters of this world like you always to agree, not even to compromise, to agree. And because I couldn't agree on so many occasions, I regret to tell you, We ended up not exactly enemies, but we were less friendly than we ought to have been. Because he was a likable chap in his earliest days, but I regret to tell you, he did, like General Wingate, have these somewhat offensive methods of his insofar as we were concerned.
So you thought he was being too ruthless with the mules?
Absolutely, no doubt whatsoever, and he was, there isn't any doubt. He knew a mule was like some men would think about a motor car, being only as good as it can go from A to B, and not care about whether it's got petrol in it or oil or whatever, just to get the hell out of it and get down the road. With a mule, the same remarks apply with Jack. He would tend not to think whether the thing, poor mule, has had its food or water, or whether it's got a wither gall and can carry the large load or a middle load or even a light load. Nothing that happened to him at all. That mule, from his point of view, had four legs on which to walk. He was here to do a job of work like he was. And he blatantly said so. I had to defend the mule because I knew 'twasn't only walk marching tomorrow, but we wanted the mule for the next day and the next day. Because I knew once we lost that mule, what the hell do you do with the load it's carrying? Because there's a limit to all of us, including the other mules that are left, and the men who can also help. And we all of us were going down and down and down. Exactly pro rata to my going from 12 stone to 8 stone in 4 months, so were all other men, most other men, doing likewise. And certainly the mules were going backwards all the time.
Did any of the mules survive?
Yes, a number did. A lot didn't, of course. A lot were even wounded as well in the various blocks we put up. One in particular called Blackpool, where we had a most famous mule called Maggie, who was a superb animal, a leader among mules. She was the one I think I told you where I would push her out into the waters of the Irrawaddy to get her started, because if I could get her across the other side first, although she couldn't call because she was devocalized, she, by her very presence, she would tend to pull the others. And these mules were just as in humans. There were leaders. Maggie was such a leader. And she didn't survive, by the way. She was shot badly. And Jack Masters, in his book, the one, The Road Past Mandalay, it's called, he describes where he sent the one of his young officers, actually it was a signals officer, a chap called Briggs, whom he called Briggo, B-R-I-G-G-O. He sent Briggs to dispatch Maggie. And I often wonder how that could be, because I had been, meanwhile, I told you, been shipped out and went blind. I never saw the end of Maggie. And I often wonder how poor old Briggo dispatched that mule, because he would not know, pardon me, the correct way of putting a mule down, but I suppose he'd probably shoot in the side of his head or something. Anyway, he, Briggo, put Maggie down, it says in the book. And Jack Masters said he saw her dying, and indeed she was munching hay, he says in his book, with her entrails hanging out. And he said, I said a silent prayer for her and shed a tear and sent Briggo up to dispatch her because I couldn't do it myself. And that's quite different from the way Jack Masters normally talked about mules, but he had an attachment for this one-off particular mule called Maggie. Don't know where Maggie came from. It's just a name given to her. But nothing to do with the late Prime Minister, I mean.
You mean he was rather callous about mules, usually?
Totally callous. He had nothing in common with a mule. He was a Gurkha officer par excellence. He was a good chap, field officer of the best sort, but nothing akin to mules. He would have known nothing about a mule before he got to India. And having got to India, he would know nothing about a mule then until he was posted. Well, indeed, not posted. Joe Lintain and he were in the same battalion, and they came together. Joe Lintain sort of said to General Wingate, yes, I'll come as one of your brigade commanders, but let me bring Masters with me, please. Joe Lintain thought so highly of Jack Masters when they were together back in the Gurkha battalion.
What are your own memories of Maggie at Blackpool?
All of what I've just said now. Namely, she was superb all the way through. I used her with Doc White. We had, you see, on one occasion in the early month, probably March of 1944, we took a supply drop very early on. And each time a supply drop was made, a young officer was made to be the drop command officer. His job was to get everything collected into one position and then distribute it into brigade. And he, a chap called Langley, L-E-N-G-L-E-Y, I feel sure that's the name, nice fellow as I remember, he took a sliding bump from a drop, free drop, as we then called it, mule foods, not only hay, but corn, were sent down free drop inside of about three sacks to ensure when it did hit the ground it didn't burst. One would have burst, but three usually contained it. And he, poor chap, this chap Langley, captain in the... Oh, it doesn't matter now. Anyway, he took a sliding bump on his head. Had it hit him spot on the top of his head, it would have killed him. It would push his head down into his chest and he would have been the end of the story. He took a sliding hit. But in that hit, he, Langley, suffered this terrible thing where his face and head went oblique, went all incredible shapes. And he sustained all forms of problems thereafter. And Doc White had him then as patient number one. I got my Gurkhas to make a litter for out of two bamboo saplings and a ground sheet in which to put this poor chap Langley. And we took the two ends of the saplings like shafts for a horse and cart in the old days. We took the two ends of the saplings up onto Maggie. So Maggie now pulled a litter, i.e. a man on a ground sheet, on two saplings, for mile after mile and day after day after that supply drop until we got to an area where we could find a means of bringing in a light plane and evacuating this poor chap and any other, perhaps a couple of other wounded fellows as well. But this chappy Langley, anyway, we did. I believe I'm right in saying it was about the second or third day after this, but I carried him all through each day, or rather Maggie pulled him, and I walked alongside, making sure. And every now and again, we'd make a new litter because the bamboo saplings would wear out. And the weight was going down and down and down, and we put a new pair. And the Gurkha chaps, Gurkhas, would cut them in no time with their cookeries, and we replaced it. So we carried this chap, and I believe Langley also, poor chap, they brought him an aircraft for him, and put him aboard, and that aircraft failed to take off. It hit a tree at the end of a bit of a runway, and the whole thing turtled over, and this same poor chap didn't get off that time. And the pilot escaped. The aircraft was a total loss, and Langley appeared to be no worse off for it. So we had to do the same thing now all over again at another part up the road. And Doc White, meanwhile, was taking off his urine with these, you know, the ways they doctors have of doing these things, and pumping it into his arm, the Lucozade, Lucas-type materials. Glucose materials, and intravenous injection. And ultimately, this chap Langley got home. I believe he survived and became okay. I've lost all track now, of course, of him. But Maggie was the mule that saved him. Without Maggie, Mr. Langley, or Captain Langley as he then was, would never have made it, because there's no man capable of carrying him, and there's nothing else short of a mule that could have done it. And we had no mules that could carry a passenger as such. Bearing in mind, on top of all of that, he was a very sick man. He had been concussed by this thing on the top of his head. He couldn't have sat a mule.
But could another mule have done it?
Probably not. Maggie had that temperament of doing it rightly. And Jack Masters, who was a non-animal person, as I always called him, talks ever so nicely about that in his book, The Road Past Mandalay. He only gives about half a chapter to this particular function. Yeah.
But what was the temperament of Maggie exactly?
Excellent. Equable. She never got sort of overexcited about anything at all, took everything in her stride. She would never kick or bite or do anything that mules are alleged to do. She was absolutely superb. And as I say, a leader.
And she was tractable.
Yes, and famous, I think, in the whole brigade. Everybody in the whole of that brigade knew that one mule. Because if ever we had a dignitary coming, as an example, Christmas Day of 1943, Field Marshal Sir William Slim came to our mess. We were in the jungle in the middle of the Punjab. Yeah, I wish I'd known he was then of Bristol. It would have given me a talking point, but I didn't know. I've only learnt it since. But he came to our brigade, and with his ADC, he brought four bottles of scotch, two in his pockets, bush coat, and the ADC two bottles. And he brought these four bottles of scotch into a little clearing, which we called the mess. It wasn't anything, just a clearing in the Punjab jungle, somewhere about Jhansi area somewhere. And he ordered the scotch to be opened and issued round to the chaps. And he said to Ward Wingett at the time, "You don't mind, do you, my dear old boy?" or something like that. And he said, "I do, sir." He said, "I think it's awful. You should never bring that stuff." "Go on with you," he said. "All right, sir. You know best," or something. And that's the first and only time I've ever seen General Ord Wingett call a man sir or stand to attention, sir. He was overranked by Field Marshal Sir William Slim, 14th Army Commander, on Christmas Day of 1943. and we all enjoyed four bottles of scotch between us, by courtesy of the field marshal. But we all went down in the, feelings, I think, of General Wingate, however, who would have liked just one of us to be man enough and say, "No, sir, I don't drink," because he didn't drink, you remember, or smoke. He didn't do anything that we did, it seemed.
But how can a mule be a leader?
By the sheer being number one in anything. Maggie had that virtue that if you put her out in front, the others would follow. Nothing, she couldn't talk because she was devocalized. But her very presence, as I think in humans can be, there's a charisma, if you like, in humans, and there's a term that would apply in this particular case to a mule, whereby she, by her very example, manner of perhaps walking, etc., or perhaps even her look or looks, all of it would suggest that she became number one. And I know it to my own true cost, you know, that when I was ordered, for instance, we mentioned Christmas Day of 1943, every time a dignitary came to our mess, somebody somewhere like that, my brigadier, Joe Lintain, would say, "Frankie, go down and get Maggie, because Colonel somebody or General somebody or Field Marshal somebody is visiting us at 1300 hours or something, you see? And Maggie would represent now 900 mules under my command. 900. And she, Maggie, would be the one out of 900 chosen by virtue of her, those who knew of her, stories had been told about her, and she seemed to fit the part, like, you know, some people do. And Maggie, my job was that 1300, I would have to go down to the lines and bring her up with her driver and present her, so to speak, to whomever this gentleman, our distinguished visitor, might be.
Did she?
And she was come up all gleaming, and she would look, and he could come up and stroke her and smooth her. He could go to her rear end in dead safety, knowing that she would not kick. You know, the word got round. She was the epitome of all things nice, good. If all mules were as Maggie were, nobody would ever have used the word stubborn or kick or anything like that at all. Maggie was, you know, par excellence.
What did she look like? Anything special?
No, funny enough, she didn't. She just always had a gleaming, nice coat, and she had those lovely, dreamy eyes, as I call them, great big long eyelashes, and she looked at you, you know, as though you were $1 million, and she said, "And I'm $1 million too." You know, that kind of look. She was super.
Did she really have long eyelashes?
Oh, yeah, she did. That's not invention, that's truth. Yeah, well, most mules do, of course. It's a part of a mule. And horses, for that matter, but especially the mules. They have very long eyelashes. A mule, and Maggie did in particular, and they were long, curvy eyelashes. So when she shut them, they kind of met together and opened up again at the ends, where they were so long, you know.
What colour was she?
Bay, dark bay, but bay. A nice golden bay. And when she was groomed nicely and the sun was shining, she had, you call it, a silky-looking appearance on the coat.
Were all the mules the same colour?
No, sir. Oh, no. They varied a lot, from nearly to black, right through to a scruffy, sort of grey-black appearance. But bay was the general run. Bay meaning any shade of brown, from light brown to dark brown. And Maggie was dark brown. Beautiful sheen. And a good looker altogether. But mark you, she was famous not so much for that, but more for temperament, you see. Because a baby could have crawled around her feet and she would not have moved. Like Doc White will tell you, if you ever, I hope one day you can meet him. Doc White will tell you, as he does, he had to me many times, that he is sure, and Jack Masters writes it in that book, The Road Past Mandalay. He is sure, Doc White, that as we were walking along, if Maggie wanted to go to the toilet, and she would never pass excreta when she's hitched up to that litter on which this Captain Langley was. The theory being, or the feeling being, that she was so well-mannered, she'd wait, please let me go, I want to go to the toilet, if she could have said the words. And she never did. I know that to be true in any case, that it never happened. But Doc White will go as far, and I think I'm right in saying that Jack Master says so in the book. They have the feeling that, yes, right, she'd wait till she's unhitched from the litter, and then she'd pass. But prior to, she knew she was carrying a safe, you know, a load, pulling a human, if you like. Captain Langley himself. I often wonder what happened to him.
I wonder if you could say something about what you felt about the Gurkhas in the Burmese jungle.
Oh, I can say nothing but the nicest possible tribute. At no time in my career did I ever have a problem with a Gurkha soldier. No time. At the worst time ever, the hardest times ever, were with the Chindit expeditions. The Gurkha soldier was superb at all times. I had an orderly called Devi Ram Bahadur, who to me was almost, I would like to call him a brother. I think he thought of me as a son, because when I was almost 30 and married but no children, he came to me one day and he said he had had a signal from home, I don't know how, letter or verbal signal, that he had become a grandpa already, and he was 30 years of age, same as me, or thereabouts. But he was a granddad, and he loved to pull my leg that the Saab hasn't got any children yet, let alone become a grandpa. And that was quite true, because my daughter was born in 1948. So, yes, getting back to this Gurkha soldier, I can only say everything wonderful. I would, if I could choose my career all over again, and were not perhaps a mad on animals, keen about animals as I was or used to be, I would have loved, I think, of all regiments to have gone into, would have gone direct into a Gurkha regiment. Become fluent in Gurkhali, which I never was, by the way. I only learned a smattering of it. We were ordered and destined to learn Urdu, and I had to stay to Urdu only. But I would have liked to have gone the way Jack Masters went and Joe Lintain went, I think. They were, they have wonderful battle honours, most of the Gurkha regiments. The soldiers comprising the Gurkha regiments are themselves already peasant farmers. In other words, however low